Good morning, everybody. I think we'll get started. I'm sure you're all aware of the usual protocols. There's a microphone in the middle if you'd ask questions stating your name, and we'll leave the questions to the end. We're going to have two presentations today, Lifetime Care and Support New South Wales and Lifetime Support South Australia. So our first speaker will be from South Australia. Tamara Tomich is the inaugural Chief Financial Officer at South Australia's Lifetime Support Authority and was a leader of the Insurance Reform Project, which designed and implemented the Lifetime Support Scheme. She has more than 12 years' experience in the state's public sector with specific expertise in finance, governance and strategy. Previously, Tamara has overseen strategic financial management and analysis for Treasury and within the health, disability and community portfolios. So please welcome Tamara.
The last time I was here at the injury scheme seminar was back in 2013, and we didn't have a scheme yet. So to be standing here today with what feels like an enormous amount of experience, almost 18 months of it, is quite a privilege. So since this time, we've actually implemented South Australia's CTP reforms. So our lifetime support scheme was born of the Commonwealth Agreement with the states for the NDIS, and also coupled with an overview of South Australia's CTP schemes. So at that time, the South Australian scheme had the most unaffordable premiums in the country, and also the fastest growing CTP premium as well. So the legislation was introduced in early 2013, and at that time there was the tort law reforms to reduce compensation for the less serious injuries, which then allowed for the Lifetime Support Scheme levy to introduce our scheme for the most catastrophic injuries on a no-fault basis. And in particular, the scheme was introduced on a break-even levy basis to try and maintain that affordability going forward. We're modelled directly on the New South Wales scheme, so Suzanne will be talking next about the scheme, and we're very indebted to all of their help to help us understand how the actuarial model was set up, and also with their understanding of the practicalities and some of that precedent setting and how to go about doing things for ourselves. In terms of that New South Wales scheme, yesterday Peter Hardy from PwC gave an excellent overview of some of that actuarial modelling. And in particular, the fact that the attending care is such a big portion of it, with some differences for South Australia's experience. There wasn't a lot of data to go on, but in particular we knew we had a slightly higher rate of accidents, and also we were able to capture our actual attending care costs going forward. So in terms of our scheme, we expect about 45 participants a year, so very, very small. And with that, an annual liability for treatment, care and support of about $113 million. So that makes us about a quarter of the size of New South Wales. One area where we have picked up a different operating model is to have our case management internal. And I've just realised I haven't even started the slides. There we go. There we go. So you haven't missed much, but we're up to the in-house case management model, which is one point of difference between us and the New South Wales scheme. And in particular, I think being such a small operation and just trying to get a feel for the rapidly changing landscape with the introduction of the NDIS and also the changes here in state government and our own disability services, we decided that in the first few years it was particularly important to try and build up our own expertise and knowledge about how the scheme would operate, working directly with our service providers and working directly with our participants, and also trying to minimise some of those risks in the establishment phase. And we've found that that's worked really well for us at the moment. So in terms of where we're currently sitting, we expect, like I mentioned before, about 45 participants per year. And after coming up to 18 months, we currently have about 55 people in the scheme. And it's tracking remarkably well according to the model. So we expected to have about 3/4 of brain injury, and we're tracking in line with that at about 70%. Spinal cord injuries have been a little bit more severe in particular having more Asia A's in the scheme, but we've had a few less than what we expected. We thought that we'd have about 25%. Instead, we have about just under 20%, but we have seen a lot more amputations than what we might have otherwise been expecting. So we currently have about 6 amputees in the scheme, and some of those are functional equivalent. So when we first started the scheme, we had a very, I suppose, quite medical definition of what an amputation was. But over time, in the first few months, we started to see quite a few people who had the functional equivalent of an amputation. So we recently changed the rules to make sure we do actually capture the right people with these amputation injuries, and we currently have 6 in the scheme. Now, it can be sort of, our experience can also be summed up in 3 words: leather, lycra, and liquor. In other words, we have a lot of men in the scheme, so 85%. I'm not sure what that says about the men or what it says about women drivers, and that you make your judgment there. And it also sort of refers to the fact we have quite a number of, it's the motorcyclists, the 25% have been related to some sort of motorcycle accident. And we've also had quite a few cyclist injuries as well, so they make up the lycra component. And I think just few of those pre-existing mental health issues have meant we've had a few people with their accidents related to a bit of, you know, overindulgence of the alcohol. So that's the leather or lycra liquor. We also have quite a number who have been regional based. So you'll know that South Australia is obviously very city based. Of our population of about 1.1 live in Adelaide, with obviously a vast remote area. And we've got about 55% in the scheme at the moment who are from those regional or remote areas. And in particular, that's going to be interesting going forward, because we don't have those well-established systems in those areas to try and deal with the kinds of injuries that our participants have. So part of what we're doing is trying to develop that expertise. And in the plenary this morning, we talked to, there was that mention of how telehealth and some of those computer-based, iPad app-based rehab and allied health programs are going to be quite important for us going forward. So while there are a lot of medical professionals out in the remote areas, but it's just not that allied health and therapy base that we need in particular to support our participants. In terms of the amputation injuries, that higher proportion that we've been expected, we changed the rules to make sure we were capturing those with the functional equivalent. But it's also going to be interesting to see how those costs associated with the prosthesis play out, and I'll talk more to that a bit later. In terms of our notifications and acceptances, South Australia is in a pretty unique situation where we have all of our participants funneling through one of 2 trauma hospitals, with some, for example, the younger people would come through women's and kids. And combined with our in-house case management model, we've found that that's been really beneficial for us here, in that we've got a reasonably fast time from an accident to a notification of about 2.5 weeks. And then also we on average get participants from the time of their accident into the scheme within about 7 weeks. So we're really benefiting from the early on work to work with those key hospitals and the staff who would be seeing those people with the injuries that we accept. And I think already in these early stages, we're starting to see some dividends in how they're rehabilitating. Well, certainly the medical professionals are commenting that faster time frame is certainly benefiting their rehab. And then some of the other interesting facts, it was that we didn't understand quite how we would go in terms of the no-fault versus the fault, being now a no-fault system for the catastrophic end of injuries, and we're seeing about half. So it's about half would previously not have had a CTP claim. Overall, we've had a slightly lower level of care than we otherwise expected, but we have actually been providing a lot more intensive rehab up front, consistent with that idea of trying to make sure that we're setting the scheme up as best we can to reduce the long-term liability through that upfront support. And we are seeing that the spinal cord injuries, while we've got a few percentage less than what we might have expected, we are seeing that they're very proactive and very engaged and advocating for the kind of care that they need. So that's been very beneficial as well. So one of the things that we weren't perhaps expecting, while it's been extremely favourable for our valuations, is this older age profile of people. So we're expecting to have in the yellow the profile per our model, which obviously has that huge spike around the 18 to 24 year olds, but consistent with our, you know, I don't know if it's middle age crisis or whatever, but the leather, lycra and liquor is sort of favouring the older cohort. So we see in particular a larger spike between the 45 to 65 year old age group. So it'd be interesting to see how that plays out over time. At the moment, this is based on less than 18 months of experience, and we've got all sorts of theories about what that might mean. One of, you know, is it about perhaps that the younger people just aren't driving as much as what they used to? They'd much rather sit on their iPhones on the way to work, you know, using public transport or other means rather than that driving. Or if it's perhaps in particular the Motor Accident Commission here in South Australia has put such an extensive effort into targeting some of those younger males in the country areas through campaigns targeting football clubs and, you know, trying to use those other methods of reaching those younger males, and perhaps that's making a difference as well. Once again, early days, but we are seeing this theme that Peter Hardy was talking to in reference to the New South Wales scheme of having brain injuries that do see a reduction in severity over time. So when we first accept someone into the scheme, we use the care and need scale to assess what their valuation and what their care needs would look like. And we are finding quite a quick drop-off or evidence of quite a quick reduction in their assessed severity, even over these early quarters. So the yellow bar is tracking our cohort from the beginning of the scheme. And even just five quarters into it, we're seeing an average of a Cairns level 3.5 down to about an average of 1.5. So it's becoming quite evident. We currently don't have any of that reduction built into our valuation, so longer term, I suppose that's an important buffer for us in being such a new scheme in making sure we can manage our liabilities going forward. So over time, we'll be looking to try and understand how we can sort of model this better to capture it into our valuations. But at the moment, it's just interesting to see that evidence of the reduction is playing out. Of course, you don't see that same reduction in the spinal cord injuries because it's usually fairly certain where you've had your injury level at. So in looking forward, some of the key things that we've been thinking about is this anecdotal evidence, in particular that our participants seem to be less angry than what the health professionals previously felt they were working with under the former full fault-based system. So in particular, there's very anecdotal, but there's this idea that we get a lot of feedback that their mental health seems to be a bit stronger. So once they've had time to adjust and sort of come to terms with where they're at, they seem a lot better equipped to be able to then own their recovery, want to participate in the rehabilitation, and generally feel that they've got a good future going forward through the lifetime support scheme. So in particular, that has just been, I suppose, a huge impetus for, I suppose, evidence-based that this scheme is doing the right thing for South Australia, and also that the health professionals can continue to support it. In terms of our future modelling, it's these high level of amputation injuries that we're seeing, which is going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Our actuaries are currently doing a body of work to help us try and understand how we can value those a lot, I suppose, more effectively, in particular with the new technological developments in prosthesis. It now means that for an above-knee amputation would now cost us, for example, about 120 to 150 in a relatively high-tech prosthesis. So just to see how that can be included in the model on an appropriate basis and how it is we go about assessing whether a particular technology is in fact reasonable or necessary for a participant. And to that end, looking at developing guidelines to try and set some precedents and some basis for our decisions going forward. There's also this idea of, because we don't have the experience and the networks to try and support some of our more remote and rural participants, how it is that our costs will play out for that cohort over time. So perhaps there may need to be some sort of loading in recognition of the work that we need to do to establish those networks and make sure that they get the access to the right care. But, of course, that could be offset with some of the more technological advances in how we can deliver that rehab to them remotely. And also, as I mentioned before, just it'd be interesting to see how we can understand that average reduction in valuation for brain injuries based on this assessment that they do have a significant reduction in their severity quite quickly within the first 2-3 years after accident. So to see how the valuation can respond to that over time. And then the other point that's not up there is also our overseas participants. We, once in mentioning how we benefited from New South Wales experience, one thing that they sort of worked with us quite closely on was how we could not make some of the, for want of a better term, mistakes that they've made. And in particular, we were very careful to make sure we set the scheme right up from the start to help manage costs associated with our overseas participants. So we already have experience with a participant going back to live in Taiwan, which has been a very interesting experience, but having the right legislation and the rules to support the containment of costs, I suppose, is giving the actuaries and also our board a lot of comfort that that's not going to be a significant cost pressure for us going forward. And then lastly, we have in place a reinsurance program. First of all, we started with an event-based cover where we looked at having participants over and above a certain level, liability, have a recovery for them. But over the past, since the 1st of October, we've had an approach where we have an aggregate loss approach. So we've had a look at what we think would be a bad year in terms of liabilities and tried to model what would that look like in terms of our ability to self-insure at such an early stage, and then rather having an event-based cover, put in place an aggregate loss, which would benefit us in trying to manage that initial strain of having a high valuation, but over time we could adjust costs or increase the levy to manage it. So I think I've got the time. So I'll introduce Suzanne up to the podium to talk about the New South Wales scheme.
Thank you, Tamara. So welcome Suzanne to the stage. She's the Director of Service Delivery at the LTCS Authority in New South Wales. She was part of the team that set up the LTCS scheme in 2006 and has worked there since, seeing it grow from 3 staff to 100. Prior to that, she worked at the Motor Accidents Authority, where as part of the 1999 reform, she assisted it to establish the Medical Assessment Service and was responsible for the impairment, whiplash and post-traumatic stress guidelines. She has qualifications in physiotherapy, law and public policy. Thanks, Suzanne.
Okay. Good morning, all. As I go through, you'll see some slides that have extremely similar, I guess, to what you've just seen through South Australia, but also some other quite interesting differences, which be interesting to sort of work out what's happening. This is just a very quick slide because one of the major things that's happened to us over the last 12 months is the restructure of the personal injury compensation schemes in New South Wales, and I think you've probably heard about that from now. But from our point of view, one of the things it has done is it's put lifetime care in with another group of agencies around Workers' Comp, Dust Diseases Board, and I think that over time that will allow us to build some synergies. And it's reminded me that one of the areas I'm really keen to actually start working very closely with the Workers' Comp people is around prostheses and amputations and the cost and supply of that. So I actually think that there will be some benefits to this new structure to us in the longer term. I won't spend much time on this now, just to say that there are current numbers. We're now at the point where we've got more people as lifetime participants than we do as interim. So that has really refocused the scheme and refocused the service delivery that we are looking at. Participants by accident year, it's almost flat. We get about 170 to 180 coming into the scheme each year and about 110 staying as lifetime participants. And that's just almost every year very similar. The ratio between adults and children does change a bit, but it's fairly similar. What I did want to point out here is, once again,
this little group here, motorbike riders.
25% of our participants in our scheme are motorbike riders. And I'm not sure, but I think they make up about 2-3% of the road users. So very represented. Unlike South Australia, we're not having quite such a big impact with the cyclists, but certainly with the motorcycle riders. And you'll see their blip. The other thing is they're much more likely to have spinal cord injuries, and they are also tend to be a slightly older group. So that could possibly be one reason why the spinal cord injury age cohort is increasing. Okay, now this is one that was quite different to the South Australian chart. As you'll see, we still are very much a 15 to 30-year-old male brain injury scheme. Whereas South Australia's, that chart was much, much lower. We do also have that bump around the middle-aged motorcyclists, motorbike riders, but overall it's this, I'm not quite sure what's happening with South Australia. Either they've got much better road safety campaigns down here, or alternatively perhaps they just haven't come in yet. That's the other possibility, but it was really significantly different. Our youngest came in at 3 months. Our oldest has just turned 103. So it's a very big age spectrum you have to look at in terms of service delivery. This is a really busy one, and I won't spend much time on it, except to say that it's a really important one for us. It looks at CANS, the care and need scale. Basically, if you have a CANS level 7, you need over 24-hour care. We would hope, and we keep a close eye on the CANS level of our participants at 2 years. When they come in, a lot will come in as a CANS level 7, and as Tamara has said, very significantly recover. But those that are staying at a CANS level 7 at 2 years are just as likely to continue that throughout their life. We wouldn't be expecting a lot of improvement in that cohort of people. Those that become perhaps a CANS level 4, we could still see quite significant improvements over the next years after their lifetime decision. But it is one that we like to keep a very, very close eye on. And there's no doubt that some years you will get a much more significantly injured group. I won't worry about that one. Just to go on a little bit about scheme review and numbers. Once again, no surprises. It's all been very much as predicted. For our full cost cohort for the 2015-16 year, it's around $422 million. We've got an outstanding claims liability of $2.74 billion, once again, all as we would have assumed. We're continuing with our inflation and our investment assumptions, no changes there. Where we have actually made some changes is that we've got a slightly older cohort, spinal cord injury, and I do think that's perhaps those motorcycle riders driving that a little bit, and a brain injury over 65. We're getting more people in that. We've got around about maybe 15 to 20% of people over the age of 65. So we're getting a growing cohort of much older participants. And that in itself is creating some, I guess, issues for us around what's dementia, what's brain injury, what does lifetime care pay for, what shouldn't we be paying for? And I think there'll be some more work around that area as we move into the future. We were getting... at about the 3-4 year mark, we were starting to notice an increase in late claims coming in. I think that was because within the CTP scheme, these claims were starting to settle. And as they were doing that, they're thinking, uh-oh, these people should be in lifetime care. So we were getting a lot of late applications into the scheme. That seems to have died down. But I say that, but just I think in the last month, I think it's gone up again. But there is still a reasonable number of fairly late participants. I think this year put two participants in the scheme from our very first year of operation, so they have they're still coming. What is interesting is that participants are not using the full amount of services that they're entitled to or that we assess that they can. With attending care, they're using around about 70% of what they could, which is good. We think the reason for that is because it wasn't our experience in the early years. In the early years, where people were using the full amount, because I think they were that old mentality of having to build a claim. Once you got an assessment, you kept that full amount. We now think people are at that point where they realise they can come back, have reassessments. If their needs change, I just let lifetime care know and it can be adjusted. You also, if you don't make people fight for every bit of thing, they'll usually settle into a nice pattern and be happy for the family to take a bigger role in some of these sorts of things. We did have a little look at medical expenses because they're still quite high. But when we trawled through a number of the claims with really high medical expenses, but they actually are really more related. If they're not medical expenses related to their brain or spinal cord injury, they're actually related to those associated injuries, mainly the orthopaedic injuries. And they're continuing to be a fairly high cost as we move forward. We did have a look at some of the other stuff around pharmaceutical and those sorts of things. That doesn't seem to be an issue. It is that sort of ongoing need for surgery in particular. Attendant care, keep a very close eye on this one. Will be around 70% of our costs eventually. We in New South Wales have been highly criticised over the years for our rate of attendant care, the pay that we do that. So we put out to tender, we had to do a new tender for our attendant care providers to be on our panel, and we were watching with interest to see what would happen, what would be the impact of the NDIA and people perhaps absorbing those attendant care workers, and would people follow through with their threats not to put in a tender for us because they didn't like our fees. We were actually oversubscribed in our tender, and we actually have more providers than we really need. So that did, I guess, give us a fair bit of comfort in the attendant care area. We've maintained our fee schedule, and we're not getting very many complaints at the moment. So that's actually making me think that perhaps it's a little bit too high, but we'll review that. Okay, so now what I was going to do now is just move on to a little piece of work we've done around a file review of our first adult year participants and ones that happened a couple of years later. And it was the reason to do this was to try and identify some early predictors of outcome and costs, and then if we could identify what they were, perhaps put some plans in place to address them earlier. And this was done by the John Walsh Centre for Research in Sydney. And I have to say, it's not a highly scientific study. It was really just more of a file review. But what we did is we looked at 34 potential predictors around demographics, you know, that's like your gender, race, those sorts of things, the contextual things, very much around the pre-existing drug and alcohol, mental health, justice problems, those sorts of things, level of cognitive functioning prior to the injury. The injury-related factors were really about the severity of your injury at the time and following. Post-health issues were more around secondary mental health type issues, drug and alcohol, those sorts of things. And the functional ones were just functional outcome measures. So in doing this, we did confirm, as we had already really thought, that there is a trend for our participants to come from a lower socio-demographic group. And that, I think, is to do with the no-fault nature of the scheme. A number of years ago, when we did a comparison of what's called postcodes of disadvantage with the MAA and the CTP database, they didn't have that strong correlation with that postcodes of disadvantage. So I think that sits more in those no-fault type schemes. About 20% of our participants had a pre-existing significant mental health problem that had been diagnosed before that. So what did we find? It's almost what we didn't find that's more interesting than what we did find. Predictors for spinal cord injury in terms of outcomes, costs, level of injury, that's fairly straightforward. For brain injury, it is a more complex environment. Certainly post-traumatic amnesia continues to be one of the most significant predictors of outcome and cost, which is quite good. You had a better outcome if you were working prior to your injury, if you were younger and you didn't have your mental health issues. So no real big surprises there. We did find that we could also make some moderately accurate predictions at about 6 months. But the interesting thing is that we didn't find that a lot of those things that we thought might be predictive were those sorts of things around justice, health type things, drug and alcohol, family, resilience, all of those sorts of things that I guess we had thought would be fairly good predictors weren't. And the predictors really tended to be more about those things that we can't necessarily control, whereas I guess we'd hoped for more predictors around some of those things that we could control. Interesting enough, we did find that we could be reasonably accurate at about 6 months about those participants that would stay in at the 2 years, which I guess gives us a good idea. And both the Glasgow Outcome Scale and the Disability Rating Scale were quite good at predicting whether people would stay in the scheme at the 2 year point. Okay, so what I was going to do now is just very quickly move on to what, and I won't be talking about all of these things, we're going to focus on over the next 12 to 24 months. One big thing we're doing is rolling out our new planning process for participants called MyPlan. We're rolling it out at the moment across New South Wales, and that is a... it's not so much a change in terms of getting participants to set their goals, but they have always done that. What the big change for is in the plans we've had in the past, it's really been about the services that our participants have wanted lifetime care to pay for. So the shift in this is about setting your goals, and your plan will include not only those things that you want lifetime care to pay for, but those other community supports that you might want to access. So it's about skilling up our external case managers in New South Wales to actually be better connected with the community and to make better use of those community resources. One of the early things that we've noticed in that is we've done a pilot for about 9 months. Participants love it. Even our staff like it. They say you can really hear the voice of the participant in the whole thing. However, it takes a lot longer. To actually get participants to elicit their own goals will substantially, I think, increase our case management costs. So we'll have to monitor that against outcomes to see how we go into the future. The other big thing we're doing at the moment is reviewing our guidelines. We won't be making any changes to the eligibility criteria at this stage, but it is about trying to remove a certain amount of ambiguity in the guidelines and to make them a lot more participant-focused than they are now. In terms of capacity, one of our big areas over the next 12 to 18 months will be this alignment we're doing with the workers' comp system. And one of the first things that we'll be looking at is they have, at the moment, 500 seriously injured workers with injuries that match ours that they will be bringing in-house. And for lifetime care, we'll use the model for lifetime care. So lifetime care will, in a sense, be managing the workers' comp claims under the workers' comp system. So that will be a very big learning curve for us. And the other thing I have to comment on that, it's been many years since I've worked in the workers' comp system, and I have forgotten how process-driven that whole system is, and not, I think, to a good point for this group of severely injured participants. That, as I keep saying to people, you don't need a medical certificate every month if you've got a spinal cord injury, even if you've got a severe brain injury. You do not need these sorts of things. You don't need work capacity assessments. You don't need GPs signing off on things. We just really need to let go and let these people live their lives. So that'll be a very interesting and absorbing project for us. We're also in New South Wales going to spend a bit of time building capacity around trying to get more people who can manage the challenging behaviours of participants with a brain injury. In New South Wales, we only have really two psychiatrists that deal with brain injury and depression and anxiety and those sorts of things. We've probably only got, I suspect, about 8 really good psychologists who can really manage these sorts of programs. So we're going to start investing in this area of managing challenging behaviours. And we're about to roll out a big program there. And the other area that we're just starting to scope out now is mental health. That 2 and 5 year project did highlight that 45 to 55% of our participants post-injury have a significant mental health problem. So we can't ignore that, so we're doing something around that. The only thing I'll mention on this slide is the CANS4 project. CANS4 is a really big group, and as you know, we rely on CANS for our costing, so we're looking to try and build a little bit more granularity into the CANS level 4, and that's a project that's undergoing at the moment. I just wanted to talk a little bit about this. It's now 9 years into the scheme, and we are just getting more and more mired and mixed up in the legal manoeuvrings of CTP insurers, workers' comp insurers and solicitors. Despite the fact that we've tried to stay out of this as much as possible, you just don't seem to be able to avoid it. So the more you can divorce yourself from these sorts of adversarial schemes, I think, the better, because it does very much still influence the behaviour of the players in the scheme. And I'm just going to finish on, we've done a little bit of a review of our service development and research strategy, and these are, and we spoke fairly broadly in New South Wales according to our own staff, and these were the main significant issues that they identified, and these are what we'll be concentrating on. But adjustment to injury continues to be a really, really significant problem. Many people adjust well, but for those that don't, it's still 4 or 5 years later, and it's only then really starting to come to terms with that. So we need to get much better at doing something around there. Mental health I've mentioned, and we will do a little bit more. We'll start looking at that area quite seriously. And the only other area I was just going to mention is that we're really keen to skill up our participants to become better advocates for themselves, but for the disability sector in general. So we're going to sort of start putting some resources around that. And I've been giving the nod here, so thank you very much.
We've got a few minutes for questions. I thought I'd kick it up and kick it off and ask both of you, what are your sort of biggest cost pressures or risks in the schemes at the moment?
Well, at the moment, everything's travelling quite well, but as I said, the one cost and the one area we do very much continue to focus on is attendant care. We have an approved provider arrangement, so it's a... and I think there's about 30 different firms on that across all of New South Wales. And we also keep very, very tight control of the attendant care fee. And that's been very successful, I think, in continuing to monitor that. We make sure that we remove the assessment of care from the delivery of care. So it's two completely different groups that do that. So anyone that's providing care can't be involved in either the assessment or the case management of the care. It's a very separate thing.
Similar to New South Wales, we also have an attendant care provider panel, and we set the rate, which is below the spread of the market rate in South Australia. So going forward, given that we expect to sort of merge towards New South Wales and having most of the scheme costs revolve around attendant care, that will help. At the moment, because we are still early days, most of our cost has been around the initial acute hospital care, inpatient rehab through our Hampstead Rehab Centre, and then some of the other equipment and therapy and rehab. So we don't yet see the attendant care costs coming through. We'll keep tight control of that with the panel and the negotiated rates. So at the moment, I suppose, really curious to see how our higher than expected number of amputees, what that means for our prosthesis costs compared to model, and also our remote participants, what this means for the cost of their care going forward.
Hi, Nicole Gamarov from Swiss Re. Suzanne, the question for you, attendant care being one of the main concerns. So given that the NDIS is only really going to be in full operation sort of by 2018, I guess the pressure on attendant care isn't yet there. Have you done any sort of predictions on how that's going to impact the cost for the scheme?
Not necessarily predictions, but as I said, it's one area we still put in the flag it as a high risk. But I have to say that I'm starting to think that the way things, people, there are other ways of providing care that are emerging, I think, because of this. We're being approached by people, what I'm calling like an Uber care sort of thing. It's a sort of a website where you link attendant care workers with provider, with people needing it. That has a possibility of significantly even further reducing the costs of the admin side of the care, but also perhaps of providing a better pool of carers. So I'm not quite as negative about it as I was perhaps 2 years ago, but, yeah, we keep a really strong eye on it, yeah.
You've talked about some of the risks with the NDIA, like attendant care, but what do you see are the opportunities in aligning with the NDIA as they expand out?
And that's perhaps also another opportunity just generally, because everyone's worried about service providers, NDIA absorbing all the service providers. But I think the opportunity is, particularly what we've discovered, is that up until now, service providers, most of the existing players, haven't actually been able to provide a service to lifetime care because they've all been block funded. So to actually come in and, because we've always been a fee-for-service thing, they haven't been able to actually provide services to our participants. So what the NDIS has done by removing block funding, moving to an individualised funding thing, has actually opened up a whole group of providers that previously we couldn't access. So I actually think that's an enormous potential there. It's quite exciting.
I think we've run out of time. If you just join me in thanking Suzanne and Tamara.